Okay, now we'll talk about reliability of confirmation responses. The standard requires the auditor to evaluate the reliability of confirmation responses and alternative procedures as part of the auditor's overall evaluation of confirmation procedures. The standard acknowledges that there may be situations in which the confirming party responds to a confirmation request other than in written communication mailed to the auditor. When these responses are received, additional evidence may be required to support the validity. For example, a facsimile response involves risk because of the difficulty of ascertaining the source of the response. As discussed previously, banks and other businesses may hire third parties to respond to confirmation requests on their behalf. If a system or process that facilitates confirmation between the auditor and the confirming party is in place, and if the auditor plans to rely on that system or process, another auditor's report on that system or process may assist the auditor in assessing the design and operating effectiveness of the electronic and manual controls that address the reliability of the information being confirmed. This leads me to my next question. What factors should the auditor consider when evaluating the reliability of confirmation responses in paper, electronic, or other form? Joe Crisella?
I think we've hit on a lot of this already in some of our earlier discussion. You know, who's responding would certainly be a factor. One of the things that's not in your discussion paper, and again, I'm not even fully convinced it needs to be in a standard. But it's, you know, I want to at least throw it out. One of the things that I think it's important to think about, I know when I cover confirmations in class, is if you get back the confirmation requests and they're riddled with exceptions, that probably tells you something, if nothing else, about internal control over financial reporting, at least potentially. But the other extreme, I think, is maybe just as dangerous, right? The other extreme is you send out a lot of confirmation requests, and they all come back perfect. Yeah. And so, again, I don't know how you put that in a standard exactly. You know, I'd have to think that through a lot more than I have, you know, can quickly do here. But I think that's an issue. And I think sometimes in doing audits, there's a, you know, there's a lot of time pressure. And you know, again, it gets to the overriding importance that can never be emphasized too much of professional skepticism. And it just underlies everything auditors do.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay.
Maybe I'll just...
We
already have something. I was just wondering what the objective of this is, because there's already something in the standard that addresses this. Not to be too, but AU 9330 talks about this already. So I was just wondering, what is it we're trying to accomplish here that we don't already have? Because there's a standard that we need to go through today on this. So I was just trying to understand that better and what problem we're trying to solve.
Well, you're right. I mean, the standard does have language about assessing the reliability. The question is, does there need to be additional information? What factors should be considered? The other thing is AU 9330 technically isn't a PCAOB standard because it was issued after April 2003 when we adopted our standards.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that nuance, because it's actually a very good principles-based standard, to Joe's point. It goes through the principles and the thought process you should go through in this instance. So I'd encourage you to consider it. It's pretty well written.
We're definitely considering it as we go through the process, but yeah, that's part of it. It addresses some things that the original standard didn't. We had to haven't adopted it. Any other? Sam Renzilla?
I was just going to help Vin out. I think what he was telling
you. Well, thanks, Sam.
Huh? I'm sorry?
Just thanking you.
You gotcha. I think the answer to your question is actually you can find some very good evidence and standard setting both at the ASB level and at the IAASB level with respect to this question.
Thanks, Sam. Ben, did you have anything else you wanted to know? Any other comments? Okay, now let's talk about situations when management requests that the auditor not confirm certain accounts. The standard does not specifically address such situations or procedures that the auditor might perform when faced with these situations. Therefore, what procedures should the auditor be required to perform to address situations in which management requests that the auditor not confirm accounts? Galen Hansen.
I think the existing guidance, as was just mentioned, I think there's a lot of information already there that there should be heightened skepticism in this situation, and you start with discussing with the officers of the company as to the rational reasons and evaluate the legitimacy of those reasons. However, and depending on the significance and the materiality, I would think that this might be one of those instances where consideration of a discussion with an audit committee chair, used sparingly, but this is one of those times when I think you would might want to exercise that option.
Thank you. Shelley Stein?
As an auditor, I think this is one of those situations where my first reaction would be to run like the wind. We talk about the quality of audits, we talk about documentation, and now we've got management saying, please don't confirm this. So my skepticism is going straight up immediately with the request, and there are very limited circumstances that I can imagine where that would happen. And I think that you've got to be very careful about that. Doesn't mean there might not be a legitimate one somewhere, but boy, that ought to be a rare situation.
Thank you. Damon Silvers?
I'm just curious if members of the group who do this more day-to-day than I do could explain any instances they know of where this kind of request would be legitimate. I mean, I can kind of imagine maybe some circumstances, but I'm just curious if anyone's ever actually had one.
So there's a couple of people down there. Hal Schroeder?
So in my auditing days, I actually did when involving litigation. It was a sensitive issue, and you already knew it was in litigation or about to go in litigation. We were asked not to confirm and speak with the attorney. So, yeah, I could come up with one or two.
No, not at all.
What was the, I mean, a matter was being litigated, and so you were not, I'm not sure how I connect the notion that there was litigation with what the nature of the matter was.
The client, as I recall, this is a few years ago, the client was very sensitive to any exchange of information between itself and the other party because it may go into litigation. They just didn't want any more documentation. They had what they wanted, and they were going to litigate it, and they just didn't want to. They were attempting to settle it out of court, but it was very likely to go to court, and so they asked for us not to confirm it.
Galen, did you have a comment?
I was going to say basically the same thing. I've had those instances that I've had to deal with.
Hal Schroeder?
Sorry, I did have another comment. I, very much like Galen, I sit on a board of an insurance company, and I'm on the audit committee. If we're not confirming something that would normally be confirmed, I would certainly want to know about it. So I would expect it to be a requirement that they actually communicate that.
Thank you. Okay, Ted White.
I I like the suggestion that this possibly be a communication back to the audit committee chair. The other thing I was wondering was whether your language could either suggest or require that the auditor reopen their risk assessment and address this issue specifically. I suspect if this is something that they knew up front, that the risk assessment would be quite a bit different going into the audit, and this would materially change that, or should, and that in most instances it's probably something that's going to raise some big red flags. And that at least then, because what I think you need is a mechanism to ensure that it's dealt with, right?
Thank you, Ted. Actually, I believe it's ISO 505 has slightly different wording, but they do encourage the auditor to consider the effect of any request like that on a risk assessment, and including risk of fraud. So it's one of the things we've been discussing. I think Bob Dacey was next.
In answer to the question, we thought the procedures outlined in ISO 505, in fact, which were pretty similar to the ones you have in your document, were appropriate procedures in the circumstances.
Thank you. Damon Silvers?
It seems to me that, particularly based on the responses I got to my earlier question, that that my intuition about this, which is that this is a very unusual phenomenon when this is a legitimate matter. And that even as, for example, in the litigation arena, right, if there's an account that is subject to litigation, it strikes me that the auditor that's an obviously an account where somebody disagrees with what the preparer is characterizing, how the preparer is characterizing that account. I think that the fact that the preparer is uncomfortable with that, with a third party like the auditor getting into that, is kind of too bad. In relation to what the auditor's obligations need to be in that circumstance, I mean, I can imagine a circumstance, for example, where law enforcement is involved, where it would clearly be inappropriate to say tip off someone that law enforcement, you could be in a situation where that kind of extreme thing might make sense, but it seems extraordinarily rare to me. And obviously, and I very much support the notion that there ought to be kind of a presumption that when that occurs that the auditor needs to be talking to the audit committee to make sure that that there's really a justification for this, and that the PCAOB's guidance and standards in this area need to really kind of ensure that this is a very rarely accepted proposition. I want to go from that though to a broader comment about the discussion thus far, which is that it's not clear to me how explicit, the issue I think Joe Carcel talked about professional skepticism. The question of how much you wish to specify and guide professional skepticism in the drafting of your standards, particularly this area or others, is one that it's, I think, a subtle judgment. It strikes me, for example, that when you talk about different forms of confirmation, that there are obviously implications to toward the prevalence of certain types of forms of confirmation. That there's a sliding scale with faxes, that some faxes are pretty much no different from a letter, and other faxes are a lot different from a letter. How much do you want to get into that? And I think that one of the questions that the board might want to consider is the lessons that it has from its inspections as to whether there is pretty well established and understood practice in this area, such that type of guidance is not really necessary, or whether there is not, or whether there seems to be a willingness within the profession, within the firms that do the predominant amount of public company auditing, to kind of just accept anything, to not be skeptical in these areas, and whether therefore some more detailed guidance needs to be had. I don't know the answer, but I assume you all might be able to figure that out.
Thank you. Jim Cox?
I was just wondering about somewhat more of maybe formulaic response here, and think about this as being in the category of a limitation on the scope of the audit, and if material, then the way you normally deal with that question is to see if there's other ways. But for example, litigation situation, I'm not asking how you handled it, but it come to my mind that you may want to think about other ways of getting at that, including, you know, having conversations you can with the counsel for the audit client to get some review about what the exposure is there, and then figure out what the right, but to figure out some way to overcome it. But if you can't overcome it, then I would think that it's appropriate to see this as a limitation on scope, and that the implications of that depends on the materiality of the limitation.
Thank you. Randy Fletchell?
Yeah, I was just going to try to add to Damon's question and Hal's response. I think, Professor Cox, to your point, I mean, we look at confirmation in terms of whether it'd be effective at getting evidence. And if you went to management and they said, don't confirm that account because they may not agree with the balance, I would agree that's a red flag, and I think you'd probably want to direct your attention there. If they said this has been in litigation for 3 years, I think you'd say, well, there's no sense mailing a confirmation to the customer. Instead, I think you'd go to the process of confirming and evaluating responses from outside counsel or in-house counsel to decide what that meant from an accounting standpoint, and not a confirmation that you just knew was of no value and, in fact, could affect their legal strategy. So I don't think it's a matter of you just don't want to do it because it's a problem, and it's a matter of there's a more effective way to get to the answer for something that's in litigation. If they just said, don't mail that when we think they may not agree, I would think that would certainly draw your attention to it.
Thank you. Joe Casella?
I think just about everybody in this room is on board that, except for the litigation situation, there'd be very unusual circumstances where a request by management not to send a confirmation when the auditor feels it's appropriate would be honored without it being viewed at least as a scope limitation. But I think the board runs the risk if they're completely silent in this area. Because unfortunately, the people in this room are not the ones who are likely to have been involved with problematic behavior, or they wouldn't be in the room. We shouldn't lose sight of the fact that ZBEST, which was one of the largest frauds, you know, certainly at the time it happened, was essentially this issue. The auditors wanted to send confirmation to the building restoration projects, and they were convinced that that was going to be problematic from a client perspective, and they didn't do it. More recently, I would refer interested readers to the Breeden report on the WorldCom fraud, where although this wasn't a confirmation issue, the firm, and it was a large firm, I won't mention it by name, wanted to do a certain work in the United Kingdom, and were told that there were reasons why management did not want that done, and a good bit of the fraud was seated in the accounts in that subsidiary. So I think we should not lose sight of those issues.
Thanks, Joe. Lynn Coleman?
To answer the specific question, I repeat what other people have said. The ISA 505 is a pretty good outline again, so it sounds to me like we've got the solution here. And a pretty good, again, principles-based procedures that would solve it. I was going to take a shot at answering Damon's broader question, because I'm struck by a similar type of reaction when you go to audit confirmations, and it's as if we're having a conversation a little bit in a vacuum. And, you know, there is something called a risk assessment. You've got assertions, and audit confirmations is one element of dealing with the assertions in the risk assessment. And to be too prescriptive in any one of these actually could have, you know, an inverse effect. It could actually be a negative. We really should be up a level, as you were just talking about, of what is the risk assessment, what are the assertions, how do you use confirmations at the right time, and there's a time and a place for them, and quite frankly, there's times where this is not the best solution, and to be able to have judgment around that to make sure that we're very outcome-driven against those assertions. Similarly, with the audit committee communications, it's come up a number of times already today, there is a standard on audit committee communications of what needs to be given to the audit committee, and you would hope that in certain situations like this, if it really raised to that level, it would fit into that standard. And so, you know, it came up this morning on concurring partner reviews, it's come up here, you know, there is a standard there. It's actually a pretty good principle standard of what are the types of things that need to go to an audit committee. And instead of putting it individually in a standard, if we think that there is something where that could be, that communication needs to get better, then I'd encourage you to go back and look at that standard of what those communications are and make sure that it is covering, you know, what we believe broadly needs to get to an audit committee.
Thanks, Ben. Hal Schroeder?
I just wanted to follow up, Professor. We did handle it through litigation letters, so, and I think Randy was our independent partner that year. So, actually, he may have been. I'm not certain. But I just don't want to go too far down the path of saying if a client, if the company says, I don't want you to confirm this, and here are the reasons why, that we immediately, it just throws up all sorts of red flags, and it's the end of the world. Maybe I had a lot of unusual situations, but I had a shipping company that sent crates over, and they wouldn't allow me to confirm it. It went to a hot spot in the world. We knew where the ship went. We knew what was in the crates. It happened to be an airstrip. No one was going to accept or sign a piece of paper that said, yes, they received a U.S.-grade military airstrip in that region of the world. They just weren't going to say that. And so we had to come back with alternative procedures. And as I look around the table and know what some of your companies do, I've got to envision that you find yourselves quite often in those situations, and you've got processes and procedures to handle that. So I'm concerned that if we write this too restrictive, that, you know, the end of the world has come, this is a scope limitation, there are going to be a lot of companies that can't be audited, which will create a whole new set of problems. So I can think of several in my own situation, and just looking around the table, I know that there are a few more ideas out there that I just don't want to go too far down that path.
Thank you. Sam Renzilla.
Well, Hal, I can understand why you left Ernst & Young based on that client portfolio. and the fact that Fletchall was your independent reviewer. Because I was getting ready to say, at least in my experience, what we're talking about here is a very unusual circumstance where management would come and say, I don't want you to confirm something. At least my experience, and I think I can speak for my firm, this is not a burning issue. I would agree, though, that when management does come and request it, the ISA 505 factors are the things you can, and in the most extreme circumstance, after you've plowed your way through all the issue, I think there is a possibility that you could find yourself in a scope limitation. But again, that would be a very extreme circumstance, and honestly, this is not a prevalent auditing issue, at least from my experience. Now, maybe your inspection results say different, but I think we're talking about, you know, sort of Halley's Comet here.
Yeah, I don't believe it's a major issue in inspections either. So, Damon Silvers.
I mean, in a way, just as I said earlier, I find this more interesting as a window into some larger things than perhaps as something that hopefully doesn't happen in every day and in every engagement. I'm particularly interested in responding to the comment, and I'm afraid the person was talking about sending airstrips in unmarked containers. which I think opens up a whole different kind of thing. I'll reiterate this. To the extent that Halley's Comet comes along, I like the board solution best because I think it reemphasizes where really the client relationship ought to run. And I think that, you know, there is a way in which these kinds of things raise you know, really large problems are generally kind of surfaced at first by something like the request not to get a confirmation. It's the sort of thing like it's an akin to an ethics waiver, thinking back to the distant past of the Enron matter. Right? It's akin to an ethics waiver. There may be reasons to grant ethics waivers, but boy, you know, the request often signals something. And I think that the standard ought to be written with that sort of thing in mind. And I think it will have a salutary effect, meaning a sort of a default of going to the board, I think, will make management think again before asking. And I think that's a good idea, because you don't necessarily put so much weight on the manager-auditor relationship that way. But now I want to turn to this business about airstrips, because I think that raises a much broader issue. Auditing is not simple. There are issues that an examination of the accounts can raise other issues. I think there is some obligation on the auditor to do something. If in the course of confirmations you discover that your client is bribing foreign officials, right, which is a violation, which is a felony in the United States, and I can easily imagine in the course of enterprises like shipping airstrips to hot zones, someone might not want to get a confirmation because, in fact, that would set off a criminal inquiry. And I think that there needs to be some guidance here. One of the issues I think that's very present right now, and in a way I think is under discussion at the G20 as we meet, is the sort of interaction of the financial reporting and governance system with some of these larger issues, and whether or not our financial reporting, public company disclosure, and auditing systems adequately capture the range of risks that are in play in businesses. I apologize for harping on this example, but I think that this is a window into the fact that auditors may often be told answers which at one level may be plausible, but at another level open up all these other issues that are in fact properly the subject of the audit. Right? Meaning that if, for example, if a company is engaged in illegal trade in arms, that might be something that would have to be dealt with in the financial statement in some form or fashion, and if it wasn't, that financial statement might not be accurate. So I think that sort of it raises this larger context that's opened up by this Haley's Comet type issue.
Thank you, Damon. Does anybody else want to comment? Okay. Now, our last topic on confirmations involves disclaimers and restrictive language, including on confirmation responses. Examples of such language include that the information is not guaranteed to be accurate nor current and may be a matter of opinion, and the confirming party does not accept any responsibility for errors and omissions. The standard does not specifically address the use of disclaimers and restrictive language by confirming parties, which leads me to my last question. Should the auditor be required to perform procedures to evaluate the effect of disclaimers and restrictive language on confirmation responses? If so, what procedures should an auditor be required to perform in evaluating such disclaimers or restrictive language? Joe Crisello.
I thought your list on page 8 was a good list. And certainly tees up the discussion nicely. I guess from my point of view, disclaimers designed to solely limit legal liability from the perspective of who responds, not from the auditor's perspective, but from the perspective of who responds, are probably okay. And you can't force these parties to respond to confirmations. This is a voluntary action. However, disclaimers that call into question the accuracy of the response, to me, weakens the audit evidence provided. So to me, if I looked at what you had on page 8, there were two types there. One was really more of we're not going to take legal liability by choosing to voluntarily help you. I'm not sure if that is a big issue. On the other hand, some of the others said, we're not even sure this information is right. That, to me, is very different.
So, Joe, would you be recommending that the auditor just document that thought process, that this disclaimer really doesn't have much of any effect on the audit evidence versus the other type?
Yeah, I'm sensitive to the people who practice every day, and you know, there's obviously been a lot of concerns raised this morning about excessive documentation burden. So I think that's fair, and I think that's valid, but I think I think that's something you could document in one or two sentences.
Hal Schroeder?
This is more of a question. It may be more addressed to the SEC observers, but if you're dealing with public companies that you're trying to confirm things with, can there be some type of requirement placed upon any SEC registrant?
It's an interesting question. I think we need to talk to the lawyers, because for once, the SEC doesn't have lawyers present. So you're asking two accountants that question. It's something we can take back. It would only, the problem is it would only deal with a certain population of the universe. I mean, confirmations go out to non-public companies all the time, and so you would be limiting it in that manner. I think we'd have to think about whether we could bring action under a securities law violation that you've. We need to think through it, and that's something we can certainly ask.
Yeah, but I'm thinking that A would cover the bulk of the assets that are being audited out there, at least the significant assets. And the second point is, as I read through, and I agree, these were very good examples, and they look very similar to what I recall seeing in various confirmations. These would be, to Professor's comment earlier, to me, these would be scope limitations, which really presents a real problem from an audit perspective. And so what you do is you start to get more and more of this type of response, and your efficiency of auditing, if not the whole audit process, starts to collapse, which to me is an SEC issue.
Agree. And, I think one thing we'd need to consider, though, is the repercussions to preparers. If we now have security law that says if you confirm something and it's not accurate, you're going to be held accountable from a legal standpoint. I can imagine what the disclaimers are now going to appear, and we're going to be back in, can I rely on this confirmation? Because I received a cash confirmation back that has 10 pages of disclaimers. And so, I think that's something we need to think about, and it's something we can certainly take back to our people.
Thanks, Paul, for answering that. Okay, Randy Fletchall?
I was just going to add in a similar vein. I think Wayne Collins said earlier, a long time ago, that we are seeing an increase in response to, say, from banks that are just filled with disclaimers. And I think an auditor does have to look at those from a standpoint of, some you can kind of ignore. Others look like they might affect the reliability of the evidence, and you can't ignore those. But I think we find ourselves slugging those out one by one, engagement by engagement, with a particular institution. And I think if there was some collective way to deal with these, so whether it's the PCOB or Hal suggested the SEC, some way to deal with, what would be an appropriate caveat or limiting language in a confirmation, what would be inappropriate, and try to get these done right the first time, it really would save a lot of time and effort.
Thank you. Wayne Collins?
On the suggestion that the SEC consider ways to impose a requirement on issuers, it really goes beyond that, too, because you've got many of these do come from financial institutions that are not issuers. And so you look at the bank regulators for possibly doing this kind of a thing. And I thought there was something in Sarbanes-Oxley or the outgrowth of that which basically made it unlawful to lie to auditors. And I think that's probably the seeds for a lot of what's happening now. So there is an interplay here.
Thanks, Wayne. That's my understanding, too. Gary Kaperk?
Actually, Wayne hit my point. I think one of the 59 sections of the SOX Act there is about misrepresentation to auditors, and when it first came out 5 or 6 years ago, there was a flurry of in the legal community, you advise their clients, don't answer if you don't have to.
Wayne Carnell.
Thank you. Paul and I were actually just chatting. I can't recall the specifics, but there was actually an enforcement case against a company where they actually did lie on their confirmations. I think it was actually involving a Japanese subsidiary where there was massive collusion among all these companies all lying on their confirmations, and the commission did actually take action against that company. Yeah, I'll try to find the specifics.
Thank you, Wayne. Ian Dignall.
Yeah, I was just going to say the confirmations that I see that typically make me a little crazy is the ones that say, to the best of my knowledge and belief. And you have no idea who signed that thing.
They were drafted by a lawyer.
Yeah. Actually, you're quite right about that. Probably a bank of lawyers. But I've always wondered what to make out of that. And it seemed to me that if I was an auditor getting something, it says, to the best of my knowledge and belief, I'd wonder who that person was and in what capacity was that person signing. And frankly, the other thing that happens oftentimes with these is there's a stamp. It's not even a signature. It's just a stamp. It was stamped by whoever had the stamp that day.
Thank you. Gary.
Just building on his last comment, to the best of my knowledge and belief, that's in the rep letters today from manager, right on page one. I mean, so you got the issue elsewhere. And here is from people who actually are supposed to know what's going on inside the accounts of the company. And it's the first paragraph almost of a standard rep letter.
Thank you. Any other comments? Oh, Gail Hansen.
I just want to be sure we don't lose sight of the fact that responding to confirmations is voluntary. And so we get them in our office, and this gentleman was right. Who signs them is a big question. They come in, and then our mail room, think of the expertise here, has to figure out who they go to. And so if you don't, and I think it behooves you to ask your client, who is the best, is it written to the accounting department, the legal department, how to best address those confirmations? Because when it gets to my mail room, it's up for grabs.
Doug Anderson.
I was just going to add a side point. Maybe now's the right time to do it. I remember, I don't have the quotes from the past, some past research, that sometimes auditors can put too much reliance on confirmations, and they're not always accurate. And I think the guidance, whatever it has to make sure we understand the limitations, whether it's a stamp, whether it's somebody who's in the mailroom signing them, or whatever else it is, they're not as perfect and as reliable as sometimes I think auditors would hope they were.
Thank you. Warren Malkus.
I think we've just about killed this one, but I think that from all of the comments that you've heard is that there's not a lot of confidence in the confirmation process itself. Not only is there a low response rate, but then you have those that have been received, confirmations that have been received have disclaimers. So I've always been of the belief that the confirmations that you actually do receive and don't have a disclaimer on them, maybe they should have. In other words, there's not much left that you have that you can rely on if you only use the confirmation process. So going back to a previous question, I think that what should be mandatory is the fact that alternative procedures should be in place, audit procedures should be in place to give the auditor the confidence. I mean, you'll be back to the due professional care and the evidential matter that's required to reach a conclusion on those assets, liabilities, whatever it is that you're trying to confirm.
Any other comments? Okay, thank you very much, and I'll turn it back over to Jennifer.
Okay, thanks, Dee. We're going to go ahead and break for lunch. Just a couple couple logistical issues. One, as I had mentioned this morning, we have copies available of what the FASB issued this morning, or made publicly available. So those are back at the registration desk. So please pick that up. Also, lunch is provided for SAG members, observers, and PCOB staff, and that'll be in rooms A, B, and C, which is out here to your right. For other members of the public, you are on your own, but we will be resuming at 1:15. And at that point, we'll start with the discussion of emerging issues. Okay, thanks.